Hey, everybody.
Hey, Mike.
So, Ryan, I wanted to ask you if you had seen this recent New York Times feature about, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, xylazine.
I've heard about this, but I haven't read the article. This is like the animal sedative, right?
Yeah, it's an animal tranquilizer, and it goes by the street name, or I guess just the colloquial or slang name, Trank. But apparently it is showing up in a lot of the illicit drug supply, specifically like heroin, which is already being, you know, there's already a devastating amount of fentanyl in the heroin supply. But this, according to the Times feature, is a real problem because it doesn't respond to naloxone or Narcan, the opiate reversing drug.
Oh, so folks who overdose can... they can't treat it as effectively.
Or they don't, paramedics don't know when they've used enough Narcan to reverse the effects of fentanyl because the user still isn't regaining consciousness. So it's a big problem for paramedics in that sense. And I mean, aside from that, it causes like these mysterious lesions and abscesses and ulcers in the skin, leading to like necrotizing flesh in some cases that requires amputation. So yeah, it's really, really a nasty thing. But the reason I bring this up on this podcast is that in the New York Times article, let me just pull it up so I have it in front of me, they got something wrong in here that kind of relates to one of the words that we talked about last week. We had talked about the word bear, B-E-A-R, which gives you the past tense bore, B-O-R-E, and the past participles B-O-R-N or B-O-R-N-E, born, which we got into at the end of our last episode. Now, the Times is using this in a different way. They're using the present tense word bore. You know, it means to pierce with a turning or twisting movement, or to make way despite resistance, like to bore a hole in something.
Right.
And they got it wrong because they use it twice in this article, or I guess once in a caption and once in the article proper. So it's just over a year ago, her right leg had to be amputated because of infection from a trank wound that bore into the bone. And that should be bored, B-O-R-E-D.
Bored into the bone.
Yeah, bored into the bone. That's a simple, the present tense verb bore just forms a simple past of bored, B-O-R-E-D. And again, this was
in the Times.
Yeah, and it ran in print. It was January 8th.
Oh, the 8th.
On Section A, page 1. So I mean,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, so this was right up top. So yeah, I was surprised to see that. You know, it's a really good feature, and it actually taught me a word. I don't think I'd ever seen this word before. The word is eschar, A-S-C-H-A-R.
What does eschar mean? I don't know that I know eschar.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever seen that before. It's a scab formed, especially after a burn, according to Webster's. So very appropriate to this article.
A piece of dead tissue that is cast off from the surface of the skin.
Yeah, so you can see how it would apply to these ulcerated wounds that this drug is leaving.
Also, be a decent band name.
Yeah, it would. Very metal. Yeah,
eschar. Except no one would know what it means.
Well, that's good though. That's a lot of good metal names are sort of very esoteric words. You know, what was there's one I always thought would be great for a metal band, and maybe it exists, but it's Narthex. I thought it was a good, that was like if in my hypothetical band naming conventions, that's what I would name it.
I'm hoping for like a Michael Band revival, you know, like I could see you in your 40s, like joining a band, you know, like one of those Adam Sandler films.
I mean, I would love it. You know, we have like a whole sort of music room here. It's not a very big room, but yeah, a lot of guitars and keyboard and amplifiers, and I have an electronic drum set in this apartment, which I'm not very good at, but it takes up entirely more room than it should in the corner of this place.
Oh, I'm waiting for the self-titled Laws album, just Laws.
Yeah, or Laws is, which we're gonna get into that next week. Like pluralizing names.
Yes. We shouldn't give too much away, but I'm excited for that because I made a mistake of my own on that just this week. Yeah.
It's a tough one. It throws a lot of people off, right? So you want to be a rock and roll star? Then listen now to what I say. Just get an electric guitar and take some time and learn how to play. Let's get into the meat and potatoes of today's episode, which is on the terminal preposition, as it's called.
The worst kind of preposition, that terminal.
Yeah, although as it turns out, really not so bad and not something that people should shy away from. You see what I did there? Shy away from.
Oh.
Yeah, just ended my own sentence with a preposition. In other words, the terminal preposition is a fancy way of saying ending a sentence with a preposition. You might also see this referred to as p-stranding, which I like a lot. But yeah, any of these
p-stranding?
Yeah, is one way, I guess, like linguists put it, to strand the preposition at the end of a sentence.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah. But terminal preposition, I think, is more self-explanatory.
And also kind of sounds badass, like the metal band type name.
A lot of grammar metal bands we could come up with here.
That's like its own episode, I think. Just a list of badass sounding syntax words.
Ladies and gentlemen, terminal proposition.
With syntax. Okay, so yeah, like, so Brian Garner, I did a quick search of his manual. And he calls this a non-issue. He equates it to splitting infinitives, which is another thing that a lot of grammar teachers growing up caution you not to do or will say as a rule when it's really not. And there are situations where you almost have to. So then I looked in the Chicago Manual of Style and trying to suss out what they have to say about this. And they agree. They're saying the rule, and they have rule in scare quotes, the rule prohibiting terminal prepositions was an ill-founded superstition based on a false analogy to Latin grammar.
But when we grew up, we were told not to end a sentence in a preposition.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I remember more than one. Actually, I can't even, I'm not sure I could tell you which teacher I heard this from, because I'm pretty sure there were more than one, or this was drilled into our heads all throughout grade school. But it was,
I even think when I'm like writing like emails and stuff, if I have a preposition at the end, I'll rephrase. I'm like, and now maybe I'll confidently go forward with that terminal preposition and be like, all right, if somebody calls me on it, I'm just going to link them to this episode.
Yeah. Then you can, you can drop all sorts of knowledge on them. You tell them how,
like, well, actually Garner,
yeah, according to Brian Garner and the Chicago Manual of Style.
Yeah.
And I mean, you don't have to stop there, because some even bigger names, arguably, than Garner, like Shakespeare or Francis Bacon or John Milton.
I mean, Francis Bacon and Shakespeare, you know, might be the same person. No, I don't believe
that. That's kind of why I made a little list of writers who had done it, and I put them next to each other, because there's debatably some overlap between them.
I don't think we're a Shakespeare denying podcast. I don't think we want to be. That's not our thing.
No, I don't want to be. I want to live the way I lived before the authorities decided that he wasn't the sole author of all those plays.
Well, I don't think the authorities have decided that. I think that's still sort of an outlying position. But you know who is a Shakespeare denier? Mark Rylance, the great Mark Rylance, who happens to be a great Shakespearean actor and stage actor.
And he has come down on the side of Shakespeare not having authored all those.
He is firmly on the side that Shakespeare is multiple authors and like, you know, I'm just imagining what people think. It's like an improv group. They're doing Hamlet. It's like, okay, go.
Yeah, I just remember seeing headlines a few years ago about one. I don't remember who it was, what kind of authority had made that determination, but there was some official group that had decided that he wasn't the sole author.
The Flat Earth Society officially right. out. No, I think folks can write in, but I think that the establishment thinking is still firmly on that Shakespeare existed as a person and wrote you know, the vast majority of the stuff that he's credited with.
Is there really a claim that he didn't even exist?
Well, he was just a guy, you know?
Yeah. And then, yeah. I mean, if that's the case, then how did he come to get credit for it? I mean, what's the argument there? Do you know?
Oh, no, I think everyone accepts that he existed. I just mean that he existed in the sense that he wrote these plays. The Shakespeare existed. It wasn't just like a guy named Shakespeare.
I got you. Yeah, Bill.
You know,
Bill
was from Stratford and, like, you know, was a baker and then was credited somehow with writing Macbeth, you know.
Right, Anyway, to get back to the original point, Shakespeare, if he authored those plays, did do this. You'll find examples of him ending sentences, or I suppose ending verses in prepositions. And it's funny to me that Milton is on this list of writers who did this, because Milton was an expert, famously, in Latin, and I remember. You know, in school, when we did Paradise Lost, I remember talking about the structure of sentences and how unusual it was. And that was often because it came from, he was trying to make things more Latinate in structure. So for him to end a sentence in a preposition, I mean, he must have felt like he was on really firm ground. You would think that if ever there were an author who would try to Latinize the language, right. It would be him.
He felt firmly like he was writing not in Latin.
Right. Yeah. He's able to realize that English and Latin are not different, in fact, languages. The same language. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then the other, in running down sources on this topic, you'll find that almost every, if not every, article on the terminal preposition quotes the famous Churchill, and I'm putting air quotes around Churchill here. There's a famous saying commonly attributed to him. You'll find it varies a bit according to source, but the story goes, and I'm going to quote Churchill again in quotes, the way that a professor named Paul Bryans at Washington State University quotes him. And Paul Bryans has a great website, by the way, and I think it's all taken from a book that he wrote called Common Errors in English Usage, but that's a resource I turn to pretty frequently as well. It's a really good one. So he writes, supposedly an editor had clumsily rearranged one of Churchill's sentences to avoid ending it in a preposition, and the prime minister, very proud of his style, scribbled this note in reply. This is the sort of bloody nonsense up with which I will not put.
That's funny.
So you'll find a variation on that in every single one of these articles.
I would be, if I was editing Churchill, that would be frightening. You know, like I don't know how you'd go and sign and say, you know, Mr. Prime Minister, you know, I just think you've gotten this grammatically wrong.
Right. Yeah.
One of the great communicators of our age, but it's just, you know, I think the preposition here.
Yeah. Or I think this word's actually Saxonic and you probably want like a Latinate choice there. Yeah. He'd be a tough edit. That's for sure.
Plus he'd be drunk.
He'd be a little tipsy and a bit ornery, might put a cigar out on you. I mean, there's another article I found that pretty well puts the lie to Churchill ever having said that. So like a lot of quotes attributed to him.
You introduce me to a great quote and you immediately take it away from me.
Undercut it, yeah. Well, someone said it. I mean, it may just be wrongly attributed to Churchill. Yeah, it seems sort of like an apocryphal, you know, the same way that like Thomas Jefferson has a million quotes attributed to him that he almost certainly did not say.
And Lincoln and Washington. Right. And yeah, this is a common theme among the quote unquote great men, great folks.
Yeah, Lincoln's probably the better example even than Jefferson.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now. Brush up
your Shakespeare, and the women you will wow. Just to claim a few lines from Othello,
and I'll think. I guess we're left with the question: if all of these famous people, you know, some of whom were writing a really, really long time ago in the Elizabethan age, if all of them were okay ending a sentence in a preposition, then where did this rule come from, the rule that we grew up with? And I had said on an earlier podcast that I thought it was from a period in the development of English where people were trying to get the grammar more in line with Latin. And that turns out to be right. But I may have overstated how big a movement that was, or how many people were pushing that. Because
I love to think of it as a movement, the right. preposition movement. People like Martin Luther nailing to the church door.
Right. Thou shalt not. Yeah.
Thou shalt not use preposition that.
So yeah, it turns out it's not really a movement in that sense. There wasn't an angry mob with torches descending on a castle or anything like
January
that.
January 6th of grammar.
Right, the militant grammarians. It turns out it's really just one guy, or arguably two, which we'll get to in just a second. But the guy who it turns out is sort of leading this charge and popularizing this rule is the poet John Dryden. From he's early 16 to mid 1600s, something around there. And he was, I think he took as the basis for this rule the word preposition itself, which comes from the Latin word preposito. But if you kind of break down what that word means, preposition means comes before. And given that, and given that prepositions in Latin never appear, actually can't appear at the end of a sentence, he goes on to say that they can't appear at the end of an English sentence either. And he even went so far as to go back and re-edit his own work to avoid having any sentences, or I guess verses, because he was a poet, end in prepositions.
Have you ever heard of this guy as a poet?
Yeah, I took a class in, I guess it was called Renaissance
Poetry.
Restoration Poetry. Yeah, non-prep poetry, non-PE poetry.
Yeah, it was a survey course. So,
right, yeah. Well, there's so many of them. I mean, you can only scratch the surface of the non-PE poets. Yeah, I did have to read him. I'd be lying to you if I said I could remember anything specifically that he wrote. I don't think I was a huge fan of Dryden, because I do remember some other poets from that class who I really, really liked. You know, I always really liked Andrew Marvel, and I love Alexander Pope. I mean, he's still, to this day, one of my favorites.
He ended every sentence with a preposition, that guy.
He may have just to spite Dryden. I mean, Pope was
it's a really funny idea to re-edit your poems for this grammar rule that you're making up, and then for there to be kind of different versions floating around. It's like, I wonder if his poems were better with when he would allow himself to end a sentence with a preposition.
And that's
we should look into that. We should find out.
Yeah, I should have done that in doing the prep work for this episode, giving you side by side comparisons.
The prep work.
Yeah, very good. I didn't even know I was punning there. I think it would be really hard to do that. You know, these guys this wasn't blank verse that they were writing. No. I mean, this was stuff that had a really strict meter to it. So,
and that means that he read Shakespeare and he was like, eh.
Right, yeah.
This is not verse I can get behind.
Right. And Milton, again, the guy who's an expert in Latin, he's tossing out the window, you know. But yeah, you know, I was going to say Alexander Pope was, it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility for him to do that, to write at least a poem ending every sentence in a preposition just to spite the guy. Because
I love Renaissance poetry trolling, you know.
Yeah, or like the battle. It's almost like battle raps, you know. like I think if Alexander Pope had lived, you know, 400 years after he did, he might just have been Eminem. there's a lot of like dissing going on in his stuff. And
I bet you Eminem ends some sentences with a preposition. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but
I'm
cleaning
out
my closet right now, my brain, and trying to find.
Very good. Just don't lose yourself, you know. Yeah, one of the only couplets that I actually have committed to memory, and I think it came from that same class where we read Dryden, is Alexander Pope dissing Dryden.
Really?
Yeah, he's talking about how language evolves over time, and because of that, people like Dryden are bound to be consigned to the dustbin of linguistic or poetic history.
So if Alexander Pope were alive today, he'd be like a TikToker.
He'd be
on the forefront of innovating slang and, you know.
Oh, I think so. I mean, this is the guy who was, even among this crowded field of poets who were really strict about meter, you know, I think his poems are the most naturally rhythmic. I mean, they're just like perfectly metrical, perfectly like sing-songy and rhymed. And it's just, I mean, he's there's a reason that Vladimir Nabokov like adored him, you know, because I think of Nabokov in kind of the same thing with prose that Pope did with verse. Just this exquisite.
In the next episode,
rhythm.
Mike, I would love for you to bring a little bit of your favorite Pope to share with us.
I will.
Yeah.
I mean, I can give you that couplet right off the dome.
Do it right off the top of your head.
Okay, so he's talking about Chaucer and Dryden, and it is, "Our sons their fathers' failing language see, and such as Chaucer is shall Dryden be."
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's cold.
So he's kind of a double-barreled diss there. You know, he's saying Chaucer is already, you know,
but Chaucer
no one
sort of Chaucer sort of hung around, though, right?
People, yeah, that's the irony here is that Chaucer kind of did stand the test of time.
Yeah.
Although no one can read the original these days, or very few people, you know,
right.
only academics, I would say. So, I mean, his point being that, like, Middle English didn't stand the test of time.
Yes, thankfully. Can you imagine?
Oh, my God. I knew some people who had to memorize at least bits from the Canterbury Tales in the original, in Middle English, and, like, recite it. I never had to do that in high school, thank God. But in high school?
That was a thing they did at Bennett?
No. I never had to do it at Bennett. Oh. I didn't know anyone who did. It was when I got to college, I knew people.
I mostly remember at Bennett, like in the classes, like folks just struggling to read Romeo and Juliet out loud and help.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
I was like, woof.
Yeah. We had to do, memorize a soliloquy from Julius Caesar. That's as close as we ever got in high school. And that was kind of fun, honestly.
Yeah. There's some good stuff in Caesar.
Yeah. So
Bacon did great there.
You're right. Yeah, Bacon knocked Julius Caesar out of the park. What they do? They smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers. Backstabbers. They smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers. Backstabbers. All you fellas who have some more. And as it turns out, Dryden may not have, he may have gotten this idea from an even earlier and more obscure grammarian named Joshua Poole just a few decades earlier. There's a great article on the Merriam-Webster website that floats this theory. Poole wrote a book called The English Accidents, where he's
that's
concerned.
Clever. That's I like that.
Yeah, I mean it's accidents, accidence. So,
oh
yeah. And then it's one of these books that's old enough that the spelling hadn't been standardized yet, so there's all sorts of strange spellings all over it.
You always want to like really listen to the folks about grammar when they're writing from a time when the spelling hasn't been decided yet.
Where spelling's all over the place.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
That's the last word.
Right. So the Webster's article on this, basically, I think their position is that Poole probably had this idea first or created this rule, and Dryden then took it and ran with it and made it more popular. But both of them, their aim here is to get English grammar in line with Latin. And this gets taken into the 18th century, where even Noah Webster himself, the name you'll still see as part of Merriam-Webster, he writes in 1784 and is cautioning everyone not to end a sentence in a preposition, calls it inelegant, inadmissible. So I think if we're trying to answer the question as to where this prohibition comes from, it's probably that. It's the 17th century or circa 17th century. And then, grammarians and linguists after that, picking up on that thread from Dryden and arguably Joshua Poole, and running with it and bringing it into the 19th and then the 20th centuries. And that's where we end up learning it in our class. And, I didn't think to ask anyone younger if they're still doing this, if they're still learning this rule, but certainly when we were in grade school and up into, I guess, up into middle and high school, this was still being taught.
Well, to be fair, when we were in grade school, spelling hadn't been decided yet.
Yeah.
I think I sat next to Alexander Pope in a couple classes.
Yeah, he's that really short guy, the powdered wig. Famously very short, Alexander Pope. And I couldn't tell you when I learned that this wasn't really a rule, but if you look it up now, I mean, every reference manual that I looked at says that this is one that we need to dispense with, and we'll even give you examples of sentences that just become absurd if you try to move the preposition anywhere else in the sentence.
I call that pulling a Churchill.
Yeah, right. Exactly. He's a great example. Or there's also, do you remember the original Beavis and Butthead movie, Beavis and Butthead Do America?
No.
There's a...
I remember that it exists.
That it came out.
The use of prepositions in it.
Well, there's like an FBI agent who won't hear from one of his underlings until the guy cannot end his sentence in a preposition. So there's a sentence at one point that's like the two of them referring to Beavis and Butthead. It's like, that's the guy whose camper van they were whacking off in. He's like, off in whose camper? Off in whose camper?
You know that guy whose camper they were whacking off in?
Mork, you are a federal agent. You represent the United States government. Never end a sentence with a preposition.
Oh, you know that guy in whose camper they... I mean, that guy off in whose camper they were whacking.
That's better. Yes?
That's a funny joke.
Yeah, it's great. And, I thought the newer Beavis and Butthead movie was pretty funny, too. But I did not know
there was one.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, I think it's Paramount Plus. I don't think it played in theaters. It's the equivalent these days of straight to video. But it was It was fun.
Paramount Plus is that.
And it's also funny how all of these articles or reference guides you'll find on this topic, it's like none of them can resist punning on this or making it. Maybe punning is not the right word, but making kind of a joke of it in their headlines. There's a great article from Richard Lederer, and I hope that I'm getting his name right, who is apparently the grammar guru of the Saturday Evening Post. And the article is "Never use a preposition to end a sentence with." And that's the kind of thing that you'll find in every single one of these. So all of these articles, A, quote the possibly apocryphal Churchill quote, and then B, have some kind of little riff on the whole idea of ending a sentence with the preposition in the headline of the article you're reading.
Well, we know what the title has to be for this pod.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure exactly, but I know it'll end in a preposition. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Even the idea that this was a rule that following from Dryden and moving across the centuries gets picked up and rehashed ad nauseum, and that's why we end up learning about it in school. Even that is kind of disputed by my favorite dude, Brian Garner, who writes that in the 18th century, the most famous grammarian, and that's kind of a to me a very funny title to hold, like the most prominent among the 18th century grammarians. Anyway, this guy, Bishop Robert Loth.
Oh, yeah, Bishop Loth.
That yeah, guy yeah, old,
badass
old Bob.
Grammarian. Yeah.
Yeah. Old Bob Loth. Even he, in the 18th century, is going to say that ending a sentence in a preposition is an idiom which our language is strongly inclined to. It prevails in common conversation and suits very well with the familiar style in writing. So he, even back as far as that period, is disinclined to call this a rule. You know, he says it can be more graceful, more perspicuous, which is a great, great word. It's sort of doubtful if it was ever a hard and fast rule, I guess is my point. So Garner goes on to sum up his position on this, saying perfectly natural sounding sentences end with prepositions, particularly when a verb with a preposition particle appears at the end. And these are, so a verb with a preposition particle would be what we also call a phrasal verb, like follow up or ask for are his examples. I mean, there's a ton of these in English, you know, give up, things like that, where the last particle in it, I guess, is technically a preposition, could be an adverb in some cases, but it's basically impossible to move that elsewhere in the sentence. To avoid ending in a preposition there, you would actually just have to pick a different verb entirely. You wouldn't be able to use the phrasal verb. He goes on to give a couple of examples of, he calls them correct and natural versus correct and stuffy. So like people worth talking to versus people to whom it is worth talking. Or what are you thinking about versus about what are you thinking? You know, where the second choice there, I guess, is correct. Or, you know, it is correct, but it's really, really stuffy and unnatural at this point.
Yeah, but if someone spoke like that or wrote like that, it wouldn't. That would be very strange.
I don't think I'm trying to think of a situation where you would ever hear someone speaking like that. I doubt you'd hear that even in like the stuffiest sort of period pieces. You know?
An eighth grade English teacher in the 90s.
Right. You know, I remember I was working at Salisbury School camp one summer, and there was a kid who had cut themselves on something outside, God knows what. And I was asking one of the more senior counselors, and I think I said, with what shall I bandage this? And she kind of just like stared at
you
me
did
for
not.
A few minutes. Yeah, I really
well,
I remember.
Folks have to understand you were like a weird guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that goes without saying.
I can see you saying that and getting a look at Salisbury.
Yeah, right. And I kind of remember even not really knowing why I was doing that. And then the look that this counselor gave me just reinforced that I should never talk like that ever again. So Garner finishes up his entry on this question by quoting from another scholar who's writing in 1947, Margaret M. Bryant, who says, and I think this is a great way to sum this point up, those who insist that final prepositions are inelegant are taking from the English language one of its greatest assets, its flexibility, an advantage realized and practiced by all of our greatest writers except a few who, like Dryden, tried to fashion the English language after the Latin. So, yeah, and I mean, I think that is a huge, I don't know a ton about Latin syntax or grammar. Yeah. I never took that in school. The closest I got, I guess, was Italian in college.
Well, when I, you know, what I mentioned earlier that I ended a work email with a preposition, I didn't say that I actually had written it in Latin. So I was wrong.
Right. Yeah.
I do a lot of corresponding with the Vatican. So it's a.
Yeah. I mean, in that case, you've really got no wiggle room if you're just writing right in Latin. Yeah. But from what I know about Latin, it's much tougher in terms of word order. Like, again, you literally can't end a sentence in a preposition. And English is much more a language where that's a much more flexible element of it. So to insist on this is really like that quote says to rob you of a great rhetorical arrow, you know? And it's something that we gotta stop insisting on. And you know, maybe teachers have, And good on them if that's the case. Anyone out there who has a teacher or a professor who insists on this, you can gift them this episode. Or, like you were saying earlier, slap a big, hefty copy of Garner's Modern American Usage down on their desk and walk away like a mic drop. You want to get into track changes, Ryan?
It's track changes.
All right. I wanted to address a listener question in this one, and this question comes from someone known as Jersey Jess, which is a great name. And I wonder which part of Jersey. Maybe we'll get a follow-up answering that. Jersey Jess wrote in and said, wondering about the word myriad. Historically, this is her words now. Historically, it was always used as an adjective, as in myriad reasons. But then people started saying a myriad of. And at first, I think that was a misuse, but now I think it's an accepted alternative use because people make the mistake so often. Or was it always an alternative use? And I hate to tell you, Jersey Jess, but the noun form is in fact older. The noun comes from the first use of myriad, as in a myriad of, is from 1555 versus the adjective form. I found a couple different references saying different things, but we can pretty safely say it's from the 1700s. One reference said early 1700s. One said, I think, 1770s or maybe even 1790s. So in any case, the noun form predates the adjective form by around 200 years, or almost 200 years at the very least. What I can tell you is that myriad is an adjective. I agree that seems like better indicated to me. Maybe just because it's sort of sleeker and you don't have to stick that of in there, but definitely not wrong to say a myriad of. And the other thing about this is that you'll find that myriad can mean literally 10,000, but people who insist that that's the only literal meaning are mistaken. It comes from a Greek word that meant it could, the Greek word it derives from ultimately could mean 10,000, but it could also mean countless or innumerable. So yeah, there are myriad.
That's confusing,
reasons,
right?
Yeah, a bit. Yeah.
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 I'm gonna start using myriad to only mean 10,000, and then when people say, "Well, right, how many?" I'm like, "A myriad."
Yeah, a myriad.
Yeah. What more do you need me to say?
I wonder how many, how often that'll come up that you get a chance to do that. You
know, I can't wait. I'm gonna put myself in a position where the word 10,000 has to be used.
You're gonna go out of your way to,
I'm gonna like find some item of jewelry that's 10,000. Be like, oh, how much is that? Is that a myriad?
A single myriad? Yeah. Or like, how many people were at the concert? About myriad. Three myriads. It's a great question, and I wondered about that. About that myself, and I couldn't remember which form came first, and for some reason I was thinking it was flip-flopped, like Jersey Jess was thinking, but yeah, it turns out the noun predates the adjective in this particular case. It's a great word in any case. So next episode, Ryan, we hinted at it earlier, but let's do possessives, all sorts of possessives, and we'll get into like pluralized names with possessives because that's a big thing.
That's the toughest one for me because I'm not confident either way. So I'm looking forward to learning the correct way to do a possessive name when it has an S at the end.
And both of us have names like that, so that'll be instructive.
I just try not to own anything. Keeps it simple.
Right. Yeah. All right. So until then, I'm Mike Laws.
And I'm Ryan Davis.
And this is Red Pen. Thanks for listening. Red Pen is brought to you by the Columbia Journalism Review and is Mike Laws, my fabulous co-host and good buddy, Ryan J. Davis, and producer, Amanda Derrick.
So everybody, listen and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And leave questions for Mike on grammar right on the Apple Podcast app, and we can respond to those in a future episode.